Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The U.S. Supreme Court is tasked with an awesome duty to interpret the United States Constitution, the founding document of the nation. And it's tasked with something more, to keep the understanding and confidence of the nation so those interpretations are supported. Justice Stephen Breyer has been thinking a lot about that job. Maybe you have too. On Citizens United and well beyond, this hour On Point, we're looking at democracy and the U.S. Supreme Court with Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. You can join the conversation. What do you think of how the Supreme Court is interpreting our great old Constitution in our big new world? What's your question for Justice Breyer? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Justice Stephen Breyer joins me now in the studio, born and raised in San Francisco. His father was legal counsel to the San Francisco Board of Education. He and his brother were Eagle Scouts, went to Stanford, Harvard Law, taught there, was chief judge of the First Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals when President Clinton appointed him to the Supreme Court in 1994. His latest book is Making Our Democracy Work, A Judge's View. It's just out in paperback. Justice Breyer, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Why'd you write this? What are you worried about?
I think you've implied, too, that there's a great deal of cynicism about our government. And the younger the people, the more cynical there are. A little cynicism may be justified, but if there's too much, the government won't work because the Constitution itself depends upon people participating in good faith in governmental processes, in elections, in their local communities, on their school boards, on library commissions. They have to have a public part. And so I think the best thing people in public life, and a lot of us think that, can do is explain to people as best we can how our institutions work so we can revive the civics class. 12th grade civics I took in California, and they had it here in Massachusetts too. And I think there's nothing more important.
We understand the people and how they participate when it comes to their local legislatures, the school board, the U.S. Congress. But how's that work when it comes to the Supreme Court? You quote Shakespeare, Henry IV, Hotspur is listening as Owen goes on boasting, I can call the spirits from the vasty deep. And Hotspur replies, why, so can I, or so can any man, but will they come when you do call for them? So that's the people you're calling on there, somehow to understand or be engaged with the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court's often seen as above all that.
That's exactly the problem. Exactly the problem. Why in heaven's name should 9 unelected men and women decide that laws of Congress passed by the elected officials, the elected representatives of the people, why should they sometimes decide that those are contrary to the Constitution? And that was a big question, and it's always been a big question. And that's why our institution needs a little explaining. Hamilton tried to answer that question in Federalist 78.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, I think somebody should have the power to say when government officials go beyond the boundaries that this document sets, and they're pretty broad boundaries.
Because that power was not explicit in the Constitution itself.
It
had
not
to be asserted, Marbury versus Madison.
Well,
Okay.
I'd qualify that a little because I think if you read Gordon mm-hmm. Wood and some of the historians, most of the founders believed that the court would have the power to set aside a law mm-hmm. that Congress passed that was unconstitutional. But why? Well, Hamilton says, I've written a brilliant document here along with Madison, and he had. It is a brilliant document. But if nobody has the power to set aside actions that go beyond the boundaries, well, let's hang the document up in the museum. Let's put it in the National Gallery.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't really say National
mm-hmm.
Gallery because it wasn't built at that time. But nonetheless, you
it
see the point.
It becomes just an antique if it can't be interpreted.
Correct. This is a practical document that should work. But who should have that power? The president? Well, if he has the power to act and also to decide whether his actions are constitutional, if it's all up to him, Hamilton worries he'll be a tyrant. Congress? Well, this document gives the same rights to the least popular person in the United States as it gives to the most popular person. And Hamilton thought Congress, well, they're experts on popularity.
Mm-hmm.
If they were not experts on popularity, they wouldn't be in the job they're in.
Mm-hmm.
So can we trust them to decide in favor of the Constitution when doing so is unpopular?
Not just to roll with the tyranny of the majority.
Exactly. He was worried about that, worried about it. But he said, now we have this other group. They're judges, sort of like bureaucrats. Gray. No one knows who they are. And above all, they don't have the power of the purse, and they don't have the power of the sword. They're weak. Wonderful. They won't abuse the power, at least not too often. And of a bad group, the bad choices, each choice has something against it. We think they're the best choice. That was Hamilton. But he never asked the question you asked. And the question you asked is a great question. If these people are so weak, if there's no purse, no sword, anonymous, a group of lawyers, well, I mean, why will people do what they say? Indeed, as Hotspur said, Owen Glendower, I can call spirits from the vasty deep. Hotspur, so can I, so can any man. But will they come when you do call for them? And for 100 years or more, the answer to that question appeared to be no. And it's only history that tells us that the answer to your question, which you are not the only one to ask, the Chief Justice of Ghana, a woman who is trying to bring democracy and trying to bring civil rights, fundamental rights to Ghana, asked exactly your question. Judges from Africa, from Asia, from Latin America, from all over the world, ask exactly your question. And the only answer to that question, aside from the brilliance of the document, and it is brilliant, aside from that, it's necessary to explain a little history.
I want to get into that history, but I want to bring it right up to date as well, because you and others can help but notice that there have been decisions that many Americans have found very challenging. 2000, of course, we saw the decision of the Bush-Gore election in the Supreme Court, highly controversial. Much more recently, and under this president, we saw Citizens United, where the court said that corporations, unions, have the same right as citizens to free speech. Now, we're headed into an election season for the president of the United States. This is a big deal, and this is going to be a time when that ruling is in place, and the money's already rolling, and a lot of people are really upset about it. The people that you're counting on to support the legitimacy, the clout, the power of the Supreme Court, what do you say to them when they look at Citizens United, which seems to so empower people who may be seen as citizens, but they're not human beings?
I say three things. First, remember that we, in a sense, on the court, patrol the boundaries. The Constitution sets very broad boundaries. Life on the frontier, on those boundaries, is not always pleasant. Indeed, I used to listen to a radio program. I think it was Sky King of the Mounties. It wasn't Sky King. It was somebody else in the Mounties. And he was up in the Canadian frontier, and it was cold and miserable. Well, I say that's a pretty good analogy, because is abortion inside or outside the Constitution? What about school prayer? What about Bush versus Gore? What about the cases you mentioned? They're always pretty difficult cases, and there's something to be said on both sides. I'd like people to remember that even when they disagree, and I disagreed in the cases you mentioned, I was in dissent. Mm-hmm. I disagreed very strongly.
Mm-hmm.
But even in those cases where the Supreme Court has done something unpopular, and where it might be wrong, after all, we're human. We are human beings. I mean, people don't always understand that. It's certainly true. And if you're a human being, you can make mistakes. And therefore, the job as I'm having right now is even tougher than you suggested. Because I'm trying to say to the average man and woman in America, please read a little of this or learn a little of it, and you will see perhaps why this institution can help you, even though you will disagree with it, and you may be right.
But your book title
may be wrong.
Your book title is Making Our Democracy Work.
Yes.
And this is fundamental to democracy. It comes to electing even the President of the United States. It comes to electing everybody.
Yes.
And you've got a whole lot of people saying, wait a minute, how does this work? There is great fear of money buying influence. It subverts democracy, and Citizens United seems to empower exactly
that
kind of trend. So I know it's a tough decision. Personal things come into play. Maybe politics, too. We'll talk about that. But here are Americans looking at the court that you say depends on their support for its legitimacy. And here's a decision that, to some, makes it appear that it makes it more difficult to exercise honest democracy.
If I risk paraphrasing, there's been a view of the First Amendment which protects the freedom of speech. And that view says, don't get into the business of trying to censor some people's speech in order to give some others more speech. It's too risky. And in a campaign, money does. It's not equal to speech, but it's necessary. The opposite view says it is possible in the Constitution to limit the amount of money some people give so that other people will have an opportunity to speak themselves. Those two views have always been at war. There is something to be said for both. I favored the second, and that is why I joined a long, long dissent trying to explain why they were right. So I think the majority is unpopular and wrong, but still, I think it's important for the country to support the institution.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour with U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer about the Constitution today, democracy, and the High Court. He joins me in the studio, and you can join us. What is your question for Justice Breyer? What do you think of the direction of the court lately? Was President Obama right to complain about the Citizens United decision, throwing off campaign finance controls? What do you think of the calls out there right now to change the Constitution, to require a balanced budget, roll back government? Is it time to tinker? And on this day, when the Troy Davis case in Georgia is in the news, what are you thinking about the death penalty and the High Court? Kind of unprecedented moment, or little precedent anyway. January 2010, the justices were in the Congress, the Hall of Congress there, President Obama at the podium with his State of the Union address. And he went right after the Supreme Court on the Citizens United case, throwing off controls over campaign financiers, the president.
It's time to put strict limits on the contributions that lobbyists give to candidates for federal office. With all due deference to separation of powers, last week the Supreme Court reversed a century of law that I believe will open the floodgates for special interests, including foreign corporations, to spend without limit in our elections.
Justice Breyer, you were there in the Congress. That was a moment with little precedent in U.S. history. Justice Samuel Alito seemed to shake his head and say, not true, in response to what the question said. He no longer wants to attend the State of the Union. What did you think of the president's executive branch challenge to the Supreme Court right there in the State of the Union moment?
Remember that I dissented in that case.
Yes.
But whether I dissented or didn't dissent, I think it's very important for members of our court to be present at the State of the Union. For a while, I was the only one who went. And it's important because people get their information from television and they look out. And I think it's important when they look out that they see the entire federal government there. They see not only Congress, not only the president and the cabinet, but also the judges. And the judges sit there impassively. And that may sometimes look a little foolish, but doesn't bother me. We sit there in our robes, and we think we want to be certain we are impassive because we don't want anyone to think we're taking sides.
But it's important to be there. Why? To be
why?
There.
So that the American public that gets their information often from visually and not through reading will see that the judiciary, too, is an important part of the federal government. The State of the Union is the entire government right there in front of them so that they can see it. And even if we sit there with our hands folded in our laps, looking straight ahead at the water glass on the podium, pretty impassive, it's still important. And that's what I do. I sit there. I look at the water glass. I'm pretty impassive. And next year, I'll go again.
You may sit impassively. Not everyone always does. Justice Alito did not in that moment. He mouthed a response to the president. We're in a time of very, very partisan politics. Every American knows that. How does that affect the work of the Supreme Court?
As best we can, we ignore it. We decide the cases according to the law as best we see them.
Who's we?
The nine judges.
Do you believe that all nine judges are ignoring current politics?
Yes, yes. Politics, it's not politics in the Supreme Court. I mean, the decisions in the Supreme Court reflect big open questions. If they were so obvious in their answer, they wouldn't be in the Supreme Court. The document that we are interpreting uses broad language. The freedom of speech does not define itself. Liberty in the 14th Amendment does not itself say what its own restrictions are. These are often open, difficult, and it's hardly surprising that different judges with different backgrounds, different points of view, different basic philosophies, if you like, will come to different conclusions. But to read the press and decide whether something is popular or not popular, to hold your political finger to the wind, that is not only wrong, it is foolish.
Is there a danger of justices being caught up in that? Justice Thomas famously has his wife, Virginia Ginni, who's right in the midst of Tea Party politics. He's been pretty strident himself in some of the remarks that he's publicly made.
Justice Thomas, in my experience, like the other justices, decides the cases on the merits. Now, remember, there is no computer that spews out the answer. I was born in San Francisco. I've lived nearly 50 years in Massachusetts. I was on courts here. I've had a long professional life. It's hardly surprising that my background, in part, has led to my having views of a highly philosophical, abstract
kind. You're humans,
kind.
But there's been a certain expectation of a kind of aloofness. Do you think that's diminished?
No.
From politics?
No, it's not. That's the second half of my book. The first half of the book is to try to explain to people, and that's a little easier, why they might want an institution that's going to decide unpopular things and will sometimes be wrong. The second half of the book is try to explain why the instinct you've just revealed, which many, many people have, that we are somehow junior varsity politicians, is wrong. It would be wrong morally if it happened, because Hamilton gave us the job because we weren't politicians. If you want politicians, give it to some real politicians. Give it to Congress. If, in fact, it would be morally wrong, it also would be stupid, because judges are terrible politicians. If you think judges are good politicians, read the Dred Scott decision.
Yeah.
A decision where the Chief Justice probably thought he was stopping the Civil War. Well, he helped start it. We're terrible politicians.
In a hyperpartisan era, is there a greater risk, a greater magnetism on the justices themselves to be drawn into that realm?
No one knows that for sure. No one knows. Think of the signs that said impeach Earl Warren. Think of the difficulties of the country being brought around to follow Brown versus Board and the integration decisions. Think of President Eisenhower sending 1,000 paratroopers to Arkansas, which didn't even quite work, but it got us on the right road. And think of Bush.
When they were willing to ignore the Supreme Court.
They certainly were. And it took a very brave decision on the part of the president. President Eisenhower was told if he sent troops to Arkansas, he'd have to reoccupy the entire South. He was told that there'd have to be a second Reconstruction. Despite that, he took the men of the 101st Airborne, who were heroes in 1957. Every American knew that they had been they'd gone into the Normandy and been hung up on the church steeples.
They were heroes. National heroes. Even
national
before.
Heroes. Mm-hmm. And he did it purposely so that they could take and escort those nine black children, also heroes, the Little Rock Nine, into that white high school. Well,
to carry out the judgment of the Supreme Court.
Correct. Carry out the judgment of the Supreme Court that integration was the law of the land. And it took time. It took a lot of other things. It took Martin Luther King. It took the freedom marchers. It took the bus boycotts. Mm-hmm. It took a lot. But for me, as a judge, that was a great day. It was a great day for the rule of law. It was a great day for the cause of equality. It was a great day for the United States of America when those 9 black children walked into that white school. Now think of Bush versus Gore. Think of it. I was in the dissent.
The election of a president decided in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes. Well, think of it for a second, because I was in dissent. Mm-hmm. I thought it was completely wrong. I heard Harry Reid, Senator Reid, the majority leader, say the most remarkable thing about that decision is something rarely remarked, despite the fact that it was unpopular, with half the country at least, despite the fact that it was wrong, or at least I thought it was wrong.
For the court to decide the presidency, in
correct,
this case for George W.
Correct,
Bush.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Despite all that, there were no riots in the streets. People were not shooting each other. People were not throwing sticks and bricks. And when I say that to an audience, I say, I know 20% of you are thinking, and too bad there weren't a few riots. That's what you're thinking. And I say, before you make up your mind definitely on that point, turn on the television and see what happens in countries where they resolve their major differences through guns, through sticks, through bricks, through killing people, instead of in a courtroom under law. Think about that before you make up your mind.
Some balance there of respect for the court and fear of what would happen if these kind of decisions were not made in some setting other than the street. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer is with me in the studio today, and I want to get to your calls. You, as the Federalist Papers point out, are the source of legitimacy for the Constitution, and thereby the court. Rob in Boston. Rob, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Have a great show. And Justice Breyer, it's really an honor to speak with you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that to me, Citizens United is really just the latest in a whole line of cases over the last 50 years that have really expanded, grossly expanded, in my opinion, free speech rights for corporations. In the early 70s, that's, I believe, when the court first recognized that that there was constitutional protection for advertising. But that protection really came about because of concern for consumers, because states were passing laws that wouldn't let companies let consumers know that there was how much something cost or that a new store was opening in town. So that was for the protection of consumers. But now, with the Internet, with so many ways to track how many people react to things and therefore how they can be convinced to take one position or another, and so many platforms for advertising to be sent to us and ways to individualize the message in especially appealing ways, I think advertising has never had a greater tendency to mislead, was the reason why we didn't afford advertising any constitutional protection for 200 years.
But this is beyond advertising, Rob. This is the election of our Democratic representatives here.
But it's all corporate speech is my point.
Mm-hmm.
Corporations now can get their message out in so many different ways, and there are so few checks on them. I'm really concerned about it. And just generally speaking, Justice Breyer, do you share my concern?
Rob, let us pick it up. Justice Breyer.
I joined John Stevens' dissent, and he had a lot of those things in there. And all I can say is, well, if you go back and have a slightly more historical perspective, you will see in the Supreme Court lots of things you will disagree with. I suspect, like me, you disagree with the Dred Scott decision even more. It's one of the worst. And what about the decisions where 70,000 American citizens of Japanese origin were taken from California in January of 1942 and moved against their will to camps, and later in 1944, the court, despite no evidence of sabotage or communication with Japanese enemy submarines, despite that, the court upheld it.
Are we to take comfort in those?
No,
Scott sent us to Civil War, the other two to concentration.
Of course not. And that is the great problem of the decision. It is so easy for me or for you to find decisions where I think we rightly disagree. And that's because there are 9 human beings who can make mistakes. And you know, I can make a mistake too. And when you make a mistake in the Supreme Court, it's a killer. It's terrible. All right, well, over time, the country's had a way of working things out. slowly we get together. There might have been a horrible thing called segregation, but you wait long enough, and eventually it works things out. And so my solution to this is teach civics, understand it, participate in public life, understand even why we have an institution like this one.
Will that change the rulings of the court?
It did in Brown versus Board of Education. When they get bad enough, they change. There is a way that old bad decisions submerge and new ones come to the surface. It can happen over longer periods of time. But really, the basic rule for any individual on the court is go on to the next case. I might have lost the last one, but I'll have a different group of people in the next one, and we'll see. You see,
and trust people, in the sweep of history and the power of the ideas.
Well. Think of the mistakes this country has made in its history. But we bound back. And why do we bound back? We bound back because people are pragmatic. They don't give up. They participate. They may run for mayor. They may run for supervisor. They may be on a library commission. They may be in a school department. They may write a textbook. There are thousands and thousands of ways. They may teach someone to read. I mean, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of ways for 308 million people in this country to participate together to build a better country, and that isn't just some Pollyanna thing. We've seen it over and over. And that I'm trying to explain through our own institution just what the limitations are, why they're there, and try to get somebody who's a thoughtful reader, and he needn't be a lawyer or a judge, mm-hmm. to understand the institution.
And keep the people behind the institution.
Yes,
even when it's tough. Verschier, Vermont, Dana's calling. Hi, Dana. You're on the air with Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Justice Breyer. Well, you mentioned cynics in the beginning, and I am one of those cynics. I've thought a lot about the mess that our legislators seem to be in over these last, I don't know, several years. And I have often thought we need to just change this whole system. I don't like the system, but then I look at the alternatives and realize I don't want a dictatorship either. It's much more efficient, but it isn't good for the people. I will definitely get your book and read it, but I'm kind of going for putting the Constitution in a museum and starting over.
You're the one I want to talk to.
Okay.
Boy, you are the one I want to talk to.
Let's hear
and
it.
And then I love it. I mean, I understand your reaction. And I say, well, look at that document. Read it carefully. Nothing in human life brings us perfection. You said it well the first time. And what is the alternative? For 308 million who think different things trying to live together. It can't be war among them, and therefore it is law among them. And when I see you, I say, and I hear you, and I hear others say the same thing. I say, you don't like what's going on? I can't tell you what to do, but if I had a shot at it, I'd say, go out and participate. Try to persuade people. Try to understand. And when you can't persuade people to your point of view, then you try again.
What about the Tea Partiers who say, let's have a constitutional convention, let's rewrite it?
No, that's their right. That's their right. And you say to anyone, fine, you have a better idea, I'll listen, and now I'd like you to listen to my idea. And the reason is very simple. Two statements. One really tough. Really tough. The one not so tough is this one. I can't tell you what kind of life to lead, but I can tell you this, because I've worked with this document, the Constitution, for 17 years now in the Supreme Court. And I would say that if you don't participate in your communities and get out there and try and persuade people, if you don't do that, this document won't work. And that's an older quote. Do I have time to say that?
Yes, quickly.
All right. Pericles, funeral oration, Athens. More than 2,000 years ago, what do we say about the man, he said in Athens, who does not participate in public life? We do not say he is a man who minds his own business. We say he is a man who has no business here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour, and honored to be so, with U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sir Stephen Breyer. His book, just out in paperback, is Making Our Democracy Work, A Judge's View. It goes all the way back to the Constitution, the Federalist Papers, the fate of the Cherokee, and Andrew Jackson, Dred Scott, right up to date. The plea he's making is, be involved with your democracy. You just heard him say it. It's the only way it works, even at the sublime level of the United States Supreme Court. We've got all kinds of questions in the new media here, Justice Breyer. I want to ask about that, too. But here's Sam in Buffalo. Takes it back to the fundamentals on maybe Citizens United. He says, Sam in Buffalo says, I do not believe that corporations should be granted the same rights as people. Could you please ask your honorable guest about that decision?
That comes from the 14th Amendment, where it says no person shall be deprived of due process of law, life, liberty, or property of that due process. It talks about persons. And more than 100 years ago, it was determined that corporations are persons for certain purposes, not necessarily for all purposes. That doesn't answer the Citizens United case.
But doesn't it underlie the decision in the Citizens United case?
Well, they're interpreting the 14th Amendment, which uses the word persons. Now, there's still big arguments about whether they should have done it or not. But we've been on this for a while, and I can't – it's a tough one for me, the Citizens United, because I disagreed with it. Mm-hmm. And I joined a very complete and complicated dissent, which I don't want to summarize easily because when I mm-hmm. summarize something on the radio, I'll get it wrong. Mm. And the words that are right in saying what I meant and why are really in that long, complicated dissent. But well, if you want to take it as an example of a case that I thought was wrongly decided, that's fair enough. I did dissent.
Well, let's go this way then. That century-old decision was drawn on to reach this new court majority. Now, that goes along with a building on old decisions. In the Roberts Court, which you're sitting in now, some of these older decisions have been overturned. You know, stare decisis, we hear a lot about every time a Supreme Court justice comes up for confirmation. What do you think about the court and the Roberts Court and how it's treating the legacy decisions of the court?
In stare decisis is a tough one for this reason. I think you would agree, I certainly would, that the court was right to overturn the decision of Plessy versus Ferguson, which permitted racial segregation. Mm-hmm. When it decided in Brown versus Board of Education that the Constitution did not permit segregation.
Yes.
All right. So we know sometimes it's right and sometimes it's wrong. And in my personal opinion, I said in a case called Parents Seattle, it was involving affirmative action and the right to engage in that in the Seattle schools. I thought the court in that year several times was going too far in overturning prior cases. So what you've learned is that different judges disagree about that. And very often you get these disagreements because of very different views of a philosophical approach towards interpreting the Constitution. There are some who say, Justice Scalia and I discussed this publicly, he thinks you should look more to history.
The originalist interpretation.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think that if I were to describe it in a sentence, that The Constitution, that document, embodies values like free expression, free speech, free religion, that are permanent, that don't really change. But the job of the judge in a difficult case is often to decide how those values, which are permanent, apply to a world that changes every 5 minutes. George Washington did not know about the internet. But we have to apply what he believed in, free speech, to a world that contains the internet. And how they apply those words, those values, to today's ever-changing world is not obvious. It leads to many difficult questions and explains in part why the court, which, by the way, is unanimous 40% of the time,
mm-hmm.
why the court in about 20 to 25% of its cases divides 5-4. Not always the same 5 and same 4 either. But you look at the question and you'll soon discover why there are sometimes differences of approach and different answers.
Could we stick with the Internet a moment and go to free speech? You had a decision by the court on the sale of violent video games. California wanted to restrict minors from buying these. The court went 7-2, saying no, they've got to be out there. Now, Justice Alito he didn't like it. Said it was too quick to dismiss differences between current video games and the stuff that's coming. I mean, he wrote in his opinion on this that, you know, you've got games where the objective is to rape a mother and her daughters. Players attempt to fire a rifle shot into the head of the president. Right on down, he said, we may have 3D high-def games one day where young people are engaged in this. But Justice Scalia said, disgust is not a valid basis for restricting expression. You've expressed some concern about where free speech goes in this high-tech digital era. How do you look at this?
Well, in that case, I dissented. I thought the restriction was a restriction that 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds, and younger 12-year-olds could not buy the most violent video games and those without any justification in art or politics or anything else. I mean, pure violence.
You said let their parents decide.
I said let their parents decide. I thought that was consistent with free speech. We do the same thing with cases of obscenity or not even obscenity, sort of mild obscenity. I thought the Constitution permitted that. The two who agreed, I did, and Justice Thomas, we both agreed on that result. The others disagreed. Now, that, I think, is a good example that because Justice Thomas and I are not always on the same side of issues, but on that one, we were basically on the same side. And to me, that shows when you're trying to apply the basic values of the Constitution, free expression, for example, sometimes they're tempered by others. The need and the desirability for parents themselves to make decisions about whether or not and how their children will be exposed to these terribly violent video games. The need sometimes for the country to make a decision in the area of national security. And all a judge can do in those circumstances is remember that that free expression value is extremely important. But it doesn't mean never. It doesn't mean that the lives of soldiers or sailors will, in fact, be destroyed because someone gave away a secret code. It doesn't mean, in this instance, that parents can't say, I don't want my children buying a very violent video game, my 14-year-old, my 12-year-old.
That was your opinion, dissenting
yes,
opinion.
Correct.
It went the other way.
It did go the other way because more people agreed the other way.
Nancy is asking online a question for you. She says, why did the Supreme Court intervene to stay the Texas executions of Dwayne Buck and Cleve Foster, but not in the case of Troy Davis? Execution very much on people's mind just in these days.
Yes.
As we sit here right now, and the court has intervened in some, not in others. How does that work?
That's a really good question, and so my answer is so disappointing because I just cannot go into cases that are right in the court or just have recently been in the court. And we've gone, you've sort of come about as close to the line as you can. And I've tried in my answers not to give any view that isn't there publicly and isn't very clear and isn't non-controversial. But that comes to, that goes to cases that are there right now. And I wish I could go into it, but I can't.
Very much on people's minds. Omaha, Nebraska, Tim is calling. Tim, you're on the air with Justice Stephen Breyer.
Thanks, Tom. I'd first like to thank Justice Breyer for his service. My question is this: I've come to appreciate that the founding fathers, either by their brilliance or by sheer luck or something in between, kind of got a good grip on human nature, and that the process is more important than the fact at the time. And so it seems like over time, we tend to come to the right answers. It may not be anybody's particular thing that they like at a given point in time. So looking back over the last several years where part of the decisions on who is approved for judicial positions has been this concept of legislating from the bench, and that's been something that's been used in the past to keep people from being seated. My question is, in Justice Breyer's opinion, are the actions of the court currently any different in that regard, so that in essence, one of the roles of the Supreme Court and courts in general is to some degree to legislate from the bench to put their vote in on a situation?
No, legislating from the bench is an insult. It's meant as an insult. It's meant to be doing something that's wrong. Probably more than half our work is reading a statute. And the words in the statute are very obscure, and we don't quite know how they apply in this situation. And the object in such an exercise is to try to work out what Congress would have wanted, at least in my view. The object is to try to work out the purpose of this statute and how these words will fulfill the purpose and how the interpretation will best carry out the purpose of Congress. When I get it right, or those who agree with me, we'll say, that's marvelous. You're carrying out the purpose of Congress. That's what should be done so we can hold the congressman responsible. When I get it wrong, as I might sometimes, I won't do it purposely. I mean, I'm trying to get it right. But then the critics might say, oh, he's legislating from the bench. So legislating from the bench is much a question of what's in the eye of the beholder, and it's usually meant as a criticism, and it's something that people shouldn't do when they're judges.
Of course, when decisions tend to go one way, people complain they're legislating from the bench from the left. They go another way, they're legislating from the bench from the right.
That's right. That's right. And it's easy to, you know, it's so easy when I'm in dissent or in the majority and I'm facing a fierce dissent. You know, it's so easy to think, oh, how wrong they are. All right, we'll think it.
But can't there also be truth in it? I mean,
decisions
did go one way for some decades, and now they appear to be going another.
Well, there are different problems. The problem when I was a law clerk and worked for Justice Goldberg, the major problem facing the court was desegregation. How could the court dismantle that whole legal apparatus that supported racial segregation? Problems differ now. And as I say, I had grown up in San Francisco. I have lived in Massachusetts for nearly 50 years. I'd seen a lot of disagreement, but not as much as I've seen since I moved to Washington. I mean, there is more. And for a while I thought, oh, isn't that a great pity? And then I began to think, look, we are a big country. We do have that 308 million people. My mother used to say, absolutely true, there's every race, there's every religion, there's every point of view, 300 million people, there are probably 900 million points of view. And people believe things very strongly. And it isn't such a bad thing that on the court, there are people that come from different places, that have had different backgrounds, that have somewhat different general judicial philosophies. That isn't such a bad thing in a country as varied and as large as ours. Oh, of course. Yeah, you see the point.
Yep. In his confirmation hearing, your Chief Justice, Roberts, said that his role as a Supreme Court justice was akin to an umpire's in baseball, calling balls and strikes, saying what laws are constitutional, what are not. You know, the suggestion there that to be impartial and that in a world where the boundaries are clear and universally understood and shared. Do you agree with that analogy? Is there another one that you might prefer, Justice Breyer?
What I've tried to say in the statutory area, I gave a rather funny story I saw in a newspaper. School teacher in France has a basket with 20 live snails. He's a biology teacher. He's bringing them to Paris. The conductor comes along. What's in the basket? Oh, snails. Well, you better buy a ticket. He says, buy a ticket for the snails? He says, look what it says here. It says, no animals on the train, but you can carry them in a basket and buy a ticket. He says, that doesn't mean snails. It means dogs and cats. He says, a snail is an animal. And anyway, who's right? And why didn't he make him buy 20 tickets then? I mean, that's the kind of question we have. And I say, to answer that kind of question, look to the purposes of the people who wrote the fare book or the legislation. And when we're talking about the constitutional area, I'd say the job of a judge in a constitutional court is to try to take the value that's permanent in that constitution that doesn't change and work out how it applies in a world where there's television, airplanes, all those things that no one ever thought about when they wrote the Commerce Clause. Changing circumstances, permanent values. In my own mind, that's a more accurate description of what we do.
In your book, Making Our Democracy Work, you look at the Dred Scott decision. It's been called the worst decision in the history of the Supreme Court. And you say what it shows is the dangers of reliance on rhetoric, hot rhetoric when you get into these issues, but also the need for practical constitutional interpretation consistent with our nation's underlying values, quoting you there. What about in an era when values themselves may be in dispute, the underlying values themselves? Do you feel that sometimes?
Are they? I mean, when I see people talking about the Constitution, I know different political groups can say the Constitution and mean somewhat different things. But when I hear that they all want to talk about the Constitution, my reaction, good. The values aren't so different when you get to the basis of it. I think I went to school, we sort of learned how to cooperate and work together. I bet when you were in the fifth grade, you had projects where more than one boy and girl took part in the same project, and they had to work together. I mean, I think we've always been interested in pragmatic solutions. We've always been interested in protecting people's basic rights. We've always been interested in making our democratic institutions work. When Tocqueville came to America, he said the first thing that he heard was the clamor. And by clamor, he meant people shouting each other politically. But what they were doing was they were arguing about what are the best solutions for their communities, their states, their nations. Now, that still goes on. And of course, I and you don't like the bad tone, but we do like the idea of the underlying debate. And that debate, that discussion, that working out things is something that everyone previous to us had faith in. And that we really, deeply, have faith in it, too. I do, and I bet you do, too.
The clamor goes on. It's really great to hear from the justice who's on the bench right now. It gives us an insight into a realm that can seem so distant. You make it real, you make it present, and we're grateful for that. Justice Stephen Breyer's book is Making Our Democracy Work, A Judge's View. Justice Breyer, thank you very, very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
United States Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. Listeners, thanks for joining us. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and read an excerpt there from Making Our Democracy Work. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.